Welcome to the Wilmington History Society podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Field. I'm back with local historian Bill Knightley. Before we get started, a quick administrative announcement on the four ways that you can get these podcasts and any other new Wilmington History Society content. First, the website, wilmingtonhistorysociety.com, and you can also find a list of 20 or so really good books on Wilmington history. Second is the Facebook page. Please consider liking or following, and also consider inviting friends that you think might be interested in these topics. The third is the Podbean app. And fourth, if you're not good with any of these sites, just tell me you want me to email you any new episodes as they come out, and I will. In our first episode on life in colonial Wilmington, we talked about, among other things, the rivalry between the 2nd Street and 4th Street markets, who the big employers of the time were, why Napoleon coming to power in France changed the nature of Wilmington, and perhaps most importantly, the taverns you would have been able to choose from if you lived here during this period. Today's focus is on Wilmington during the Revolutionary War itself. For a critical period during the summer and fall of 1777, Delaware's largest city was at the center of events. The outcome of the war was truly in the balance, and it was not going very well for the rebels. Many of the biggest names from American history were here in Wilmington, especially before and during the very important Battle of the Brandywine, all of which we're going to talk about today. Bill, welcome back. How are you doing today?
Hi, Nathan. Nice to be back.
Let's start by establishing for our listeners the Wilmington scene during the 10 or 15 years leading up to the rebellion. Great Britain sends over a huge number of troops to fight the French and Indian War. They win, but the cost is enormous. Parliament is broke to raise money. It says to the colonies, you got to help us pay for this. And it imposes a number of new taxes, one being the Stamp Act. Throughout the colonies, this outrages. But what really frustrates me as a resident of Wilmington is how, if you go to a library or a bookstore, you can find volumes about the big names, Hancock and Adams in Boston, or Franklin in Philly, Jefferson in Virginia, and how they reacted. Very little about what was happening here in Delaware and Wilmington. So what's the reaction to these new taxes here in Wilmington, Bill?
Well, in Wilmington, of course, they had the same, generally the same reaction as you find throughout the colonies. And the Stamp Act, I think we all remember this from a high school history exam, the British passed the Stamp Act in 1765. And as you said, what they were trying to do was raise money to pay for what we call the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, which ended in 1763. Now, the Stamp Act, the way it affected people's lives was you had to have a stamp on every paper product that was produced. That meant newspapers. It meant even playing cards. So this got into everybody's life in one way or the other. Now, the tax itself wasn't that bad. It was the principle of the thing that really riled the people all throughout the colonies. And basically, the principle was that the Parliament in England didn't have the authority to tax the colonies. Only the assemblies within the colonies could tax their own people. So if you were living in Wilmington, daily life was pretty much disrupted with this Stamp Act. And what made it worse is that a lot of the colonial courts in different colonies didn't really take it very seriously. So the violators were sort of given a wink and a nod. And when the British got wind of this, they started trying the violators in what they called admiralty courts without juries. So that even made it worse. So you had this enormous reaction to the Stamp Act. Now, in Delaware, the assembly actually passed a non-importation agreement, which meant that merchants were not supposed to import the goods related to the Stamp Act. And you know, you had a Stamp Act Congress, which was really the first assembly of colonists to meet to look at all these issues. Now, we actually sent Thomas McCain and Caesar Rodney to the Stamp Act Congress. They put together a petition, they sent it to the king, they sent it to the Parliament, and actually it was very deferential to the king. They didn't have any animosity at all to the king. They put it all on the Parliament. Good news is that the Parliament eventually repealed the Stamp Act a year later in 1766. In fact, Caesar Rodney and Thomas McCain were designated to write the what amounts to a thank you letter to the king, and it's pretty interesting. They thank him profusely for his magnanimous decision. But what ends up happening is a year later, the Townshend Acts are passed in 1767, and it's another tax. And this one's even worse. They tax them on goods. The Parliament figured it could not be made here in the colonies. English china, glass, lead, paint, and of course, tea. And you all know where that leads. They start taxing the tea. So now you've got even a worse situation. The Delaware Assembly passes another non-importation agreement, so we're not going to import this stuff, and puts a lot of pressure on merchants not to accept any of these goods. In fact, there was some indication that the British were going to ship, or at least merchants were going to bring tea up to Philadelphia via the Delaware River. So all the river pilots in Delaware were encouraged, really threatened, not to guide any ships coming up the Delaware River to Philadelphia that had tea in their cargo. And in fact, it did not happen. Philadelphia didn't get tea. So you once again have a situation of taxation without representation. That's where that whole movement started. And this leads to a number of other things. The British then sent troops into the colonies, mostly up in the New England colonies. We didn't get them here in Wilmington. But you all know they sent troops to enforce these taxes. That led to quartering acts. It led to things in Boston in 1770, the Boston Massacre, which we all know about. 1773, you have the Boston Tea Party. And then eventually many, many other things happen. I'm going to sort of skip over them, but you get to 1776 and independence. So in Wilmington, these taxes did have an effect. They were very irritating to the people, and it certainly didn't cause good feelings of the mother country.
In the first episode, you spoke of the mills along the river in Wilmington. Do we know of the specific reaction of any of those major mill owners? Were there any letters that you've come across or know of in terms of what they're saying, in terms of how their business may have been affected?
Well, lucky for them, these taxes didn't affect grains, didn't affect the grinding of corn or wheat. And most of the trade that our mills, our eight mills, had we had eight mills in Wilmington around 1777. All that trade was done within the United States, and some was done with the West Indies. So these taxes really didn't affect them. So I don't really know of any way that they would have gotten involved. And remember, all the mills were run by Quakers, members of the Society of Friends, and their primary emphasis during this period was to stay out of politics. So they would have followed the law. They would have done everything they could to avoid confrontation or politics, and I don't think they got involved in any political way. Now, you did see Joseph Tatnall later actually support the Continental Army with grain, which he did at great risk to himself. But as far as protesting the British government, I don't think you saw any of that among the mill owners.
So I guess if you didn't like tea and your business involved grain or mills, these new taxes weren't really affecting them.
No, but I'm sure there were effects in other ways. I mean, some of these commodities needed to be purchased, lead for glass and things like that. And I know there was a movement during this period to actually try to make these things in America. And to some extent that succeeded.
War begins. What are general statements we can make about where Wilmington's loyalties lay, or the loyalties of factions in the city of Wilmington, once the actual war breaks out?
Wilmington was a mixed bag, much like Delaware was a mixed bag. And Delaware, let's start with the state and kind of work our way down to Wilmington. Delaware had a high percentage of loyalists, and this was especially true in Sussex County and Kent. Not everybody was down with the revolution. And the Continental Congress in 1777 actually identified in its journal three counties which they considered to be disloyal, if you will, having such a high percentage of loyalists. And these counties were Worcester and Somerset in Maryland, down on the Eastern Shore, and Sussex County in Delaware. And the Continental Congress actually authorized the state militias to go in and arrest the loyalists and confiscate their weapons. So it was always in the background in Delaware. In fact, Caesar Rodney and many others in Delaware, Caesar Rodney was, of course, the commander of the Delaware militia, was always tangling, it seems, with some kind of loyalist problem in the lower two counties. So it was a pretty significant thing in Delaware. In fact, John Dickinson, who owned an estate, Poplar Hill, down near Dover, his house was actually burned by loyalists in 1781. So it was a tough place. There wasn't a unanimous opinion for independence in Delaware. And I might add here that it was so pronounced that in the British Army, there were whole units of Americans that fought in the British Army. In fact, at the Battle of Brandywine, there was a regiment of Queen's Rangers, which were all American loyalists that fought for the British, and they fought quite well at Brandywine. So you had that anomaly of having regiments, whole regiments of Americans that fought for the British during the war. So the loyalist problem, in fact, there's some historians that think that Delaware had the highest proportion of any of the colonies of loyalists. It was a tough issue. Benjamin Franklin's own son was a committed loyalist. He was the governor of New Jersey. In fact, he actually tried to raise recruits for the British Army. So it was everywhere, and Delaware had its share of that. In Wilmington now, you had significant people, a significant amount of people that were on the side of independence. But then you also had the Society of Friends here, and the Society of Friends told their brethren, do not be involved in politics, stay out of it. And in fact, they went so far as to tell all their members not to even circulate continental currency, not even touch it, because it was considered political. So they were kind of caught in the middle. And I think they would have preferred just to have their business dealings and go about their business and not have to make a choice one way or another. But they were a significant part of the business community and the population in Wilmington, so you can't ignore them during this period. And the British, as we'll see later, as we discuss this later today, the British had to deal with them. And they had some interesting dealings back and forth with the Society of Friends of Wilmington. So there was not total, it wasn't like New England where you had a really high percentage of people that wanted independence. You always had in Delaware, and to some degree in Wilmington, in the background, a loyalist sentiment.
Before we get to the events of the second half of 1777, where the war and the combat really comes to the Wilmington area, let's step back and look at the 30,000 foot picture. July 4th, 1776, the colonists declare their independence. Brits are not impressed, and they launch 34,000 troops, and they take New York City. If you're here in Wilmington or in New York in the summer of 1776, you might not be confident of the Continental Army's chances. They just had their biggest city occupied by the British just after declaring independence. Then fast forward a little bit to mid-1777, British General Howe smells blood, senses an opportunity to deal a knockout blow. July 20th, 1777, a massive British fleet, nearly 300 ships, set sail from New York Harbor. But it's sailing far enough away from the coast that nobody knows where they're going. Are they going north? Are they going south? What's General Howe thinking? What's the British strategic view in a nutshell? And the same for George Washington.
Well, what General Howe is thinking at this point, he's got one word on his mind, Philadelphia. And he's thinking that if he can capture the capital of colonial America, he can quickly put an end to this rebellion. So that is his thinking as he embarks this pretty large British army on all the ships you just talked about. Now, Washington's not exactly sure where he's going, but he always thinks in the back of his mind he could be heading to Philadelphia. And of course, he's right about that. So what Howe does is he comes down the coast, and his intention is actually to come up through the Delaware Bay and approach Philadelphia by the Delaware River. He gets into the bay, and his brother is actually the admiral in charge of the fleet, and there's already a British ship in the bay, HMS Roebuck. And HMS Roebuck has been operating in Delaware River and Delaware Bay for over a year. And his captain is a pretty smart guy. His name is Hammond, Andrew Snape Hammond. And Hammond comes aboard the flagship, and there's a discussion. And we don't know all the details, but as a result of that discussion, Howe decides it's too dangerous to proceed up the Delaware River. And of course, there were defenses along the river. And the closer you got to Philadelphia, you had Fort Mifflin and Fort Mercer right across from each other, just south of Philadelphia, with a lot of cannon, and it was a small riverine navy, if you will, the Pennsylvania State Navy. So there were some military obstacles that put the British at risk by coming up the river. And of course, if they came up the Delaware River, their ability to maneuver is pretty limited. And many people think that Howe's objective was to come up and actually land between Wilmington and Newcastle and approach Philadelphia up the King's Highway, what we call Philadelphia Pike now, and you get to northern Delaware. So anyway, the decision is made not to come up the river, but to go further south and come up through the Chesapeake Bay. And this is what Howe does. He brings that enormous fleet up to Chesapeake Bay, and he ends up landing the force at Head of Elk, which is current-day Elkton. And even when he lands there, he is only 60 miles from Philadelphia. So his idea is he's going to approach Philadelphia from the back door, if you will. He's going to come in from a different direction. Washington figures this out. He's got reports. He does have some pretty good intelligence. So he moves the Continental Army down through New Jersey, through Philadelphia, and into Delaware. And his idea is he's going to block Howe's advance to Philadelphia, and he thinks it's going to be done right in Wilmington. He figures that Howe's going to take the most direct route. He's going to come up the King's Highway, which leads right through Wilmington. So Washington's intent is to move the Continental Army to Wilmington and block and have this sort of decisive battle right here in Wilmington. And that's what brings the Continental Army to Wilmington.
How big was that army? Where exactly did it go in Wilmington when it arrived? Who's in that army that we might recognize today? And what do they do while they're in Wilmington?
The army itself, there's a lot of varying opinions on how big the army was, but I think the historical consensus is probably about 14,500 is about right. And that included in that figure about 2,000 militia. The rest of them were organized in regular Continental Army regiments. So they come into Wilmington via the King's Highway. Washington marches directly down the Philadelphia Pike. He actually, the main units he's with actually spend a night in the Neyman's Road area. They actually camped right at the Neyman's Creek. Washington himself proceeds on into Wilmington, and this was on the 25th of August of 1777. In fact, I have a letter he wrote to John Hancock, and I'll quote it. It says here, quote, "After breakfast, I intend to set out for Wilmington with the light horse to reconnoiter the country and to obtain the best information I can." And signed, George Washington, the 25th of August, Chester. So he was in Chester when he wrote that. So his intention was to quickly get to Wilmington. And when he first saw the light horse, the Continental Army had four regiments of dragoons. They were very under strength. It was probably three or four hundred at the most. But they accompanied Washington in Wilmington, and he immediately went out looking at the road network to try to find out what the lay of the land was, where the strategic terrain would be. He also, at that time, the Continental Congress actually issues orders to muster the militia of Delaware. And Washington expects about 1,000 troops will be mustered in the militia. So Brigadier General Caesar Rodney, who is the militia head at the time, he is out trying to gather the militia, actually Middletown, and to support Washington. And there's a lot of back and forth between Caesar Rodney and George Washington when he comes to Wilmington, because he really expected a lot out of the militia. And we'll talk about this later. They didn't quite perform as he thought, but that's just the way it goes. The militia never could get its act together there to help Washington the way he thought they were going to. So you've got the main army then coming down Philadelphia Pike into Wilmington, and it consisted of 11 infantry brigades. I think there were two militia brigades. There was, of course, an artillery train, and then these Continental Dragoons, totaling 4,500 people. So they moved through the city, and they occupied the high ground that Alexander Hamilton writes. He calls it the Heights of Wilmington. And we don't really think of Wilmington as having heights, but in those days, the ground looked a lot more prominent than it does today. So the army actually comes into Wilmington, crosses over the Brandywine, and then takes up position on places you would know today, like Quaker Hill, the high ground that's around Broome Street where there's a big church up there, St. Elizabeth's sits today, that was occupied by the army. You know, any high ground that you can see today that overlooks I-95, that's where the army was. That's where they occupied, because they thought the British were going to come right up from the south. So that's where they wanted to meet them. They also occupied ground along the Brandywine River, right near where the Brandywine Bridge is today, because they were intent on making sure the British, in the worst case scenario, didn't cross the river, especially at the bridge location. So a lot of troops there. They sent troops down to Christiana Bridge to guard the bridge and provide early warning, and generally set about defending the city. So this was a huge, huge occupation, if you will, considering the population of Wilmington is only 1,250 at the time, and now you've got upwards of almost 15,000 Continental troops now occupying the city.
Yeah.
So that's generally the lay of the land. Now, I might add one other thing, that when Washington comes to Wilmington, of course, he's not really familiar with all the details, you know, the road networks and the terrain, and a fellow named Jacob Broom, who Broom Street is named for, who is a surveyor here in Wilmington, he makes Washington a map, and he makes him a map of the local area, and this is the historians say that this map was key to Washington understanding the lay of the land around Wilmington, and he used this map for his reconnaissance, and he did too. Washington actually did a reconnaissance all the way down to Iron Hill, where the British were landing, and actually viewed the British down there, and then he did a second reconnaissance up the Brandywine River, where he actually rode all the way up the river to the Chads Fort. This is before the Battle of the Brandywine now, and he's using Jacob Broom's map. I have a copy of that map, and Washington actually annotates in his own handwriting on the map, and it's a fascinating document to see. And we have to remember that the Brandywine River back then was a lot deeper than it is today. So it was a bigger obstacle than we think of today. A lot of us, you know, we see the Brandywine, and in most places today you can almost walk or wade across the Brandywine. But back in those days were a lot more dams along the river, and it was pretty deep. In fact, Washington writes between Wilmington and what we know today as Thompson's Bridge, he writes on there, he calls it places unfordable. So it was very, very deep in that area. So fords along the river were absolutely critical. And I might add that during that reconnaissance, on the 31st of August, Washington returns to Wilmington, and he orders two battalions of troops to guard two of the fords north of Wilmington, because he thought there was a danger the British could come around and flank him. And those two fords are familiar to people today. There's bridges, of course, there today, and one is in Rockland, Delaware. And he orders 250 troops to guard that ford, and to guard a ford north of that called Gibson's Ford. And we know Gibson's Ford today as Smith's Bridge. So if you ever cross that old covered bridge, or you're ever down in Rockland, 250 or so years ago, the Continental Army had troops at both of those locations guarding against any British incursion. So that was all a result of Washington's reconnaissance during this period. So he was really all over the Wilmington area back then in 1777.
Before we talk about the actual battle itself, who were some of the famous personalities, maybe not at the time, but people that would go on to be very famous personalities? There was quite a few of them here with Washington's forces, isn't that right?
Yes. Yes, there were. And I'll just give you a few of the highlighted ones here. There were many more than this, but I think people will be surprised at who was here in Wilmington in August and September of 1777. Of course, there's George Washington himself, and he stayed. His headquarters was at 3rd and West. Alexander Hamilton, who was on Washington's staff as one of his aides-de-camps. He likely stayed at West Street. You can see a couple of the original houses at 3rd and West still stand today. Unfortunately, Washington's headquarters does not. But I would say that Hamilton probably stayed in one of those houses very close to Washington. Washington called his staff his family. And many times you'll see that in his writings. He said the family did this or the family did that. He's referring to his close aides and his staff. So his family stayed right around him down there on the 3rd and West area. Lafayette and Mad Anthony Wayne, General Wayne, both of them stayed at 1803 North Market in Brandywine Village, where you were talking about taking your walks. People drive by there all the time and probably never realize that who actually stayed in that house, and that house still stands today. Henry Knox, who would later become the Secretary of War, Nathaniel Greene. They stayed at inns in the city during this period of time. There's a fellow named Thomas Pickering. He's going to be the future Secretary of State under John Adams, and he was Washington's chief of staff. He stayed in one of the inns, and we think it's probably stayed in the Sign of the Ship on Market Street. A fellow named James Monroe, who would become the future president of the United States, was in the 3rd Virginia Regiment, and he was in Wilmington. A guy named John Marshall, he was also in a Virginia regiment, and he becomes the future Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. In fact, John Marshall, Lieutenant John Marshall, ends up being one of the fellows that fights at Cooch's Bridge, which is the first battle, the only battle of the Revolution fought on Delaware soil, and that takes place during this period of time. A fellow named Light Horse Harry Lee, that's Robert E. Lee's father, is here in Wilmington as part of George Washington's Dragoons. The last guy I'll name is a fellow that you probably heard about, Kazimierz Pulaski, a Polish gentleman, officer, who sometimes is referred to as the father of American cavalry, and he was here in Wilmington. He had just arrived, actually, just like Lafayette, and this was his first foray with the Continental Army. And in fact, during the time that Washington is in Wilmington, he actually writes a letter to the Continental Congress asking them what he can do with Pulaski, where's the best place to use him. He wants to use him in the cavalry, but he doesn't want to offend any American officers who are already there, so it's kind of a political issue, but it's very interesting. And all these people are right here in Wilmington.
And Pulaski, of course, got a school named after him in the city of Wilmington.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think there used to be a Pulaski Day Parade, too, in Wilmington. Yeah.
Washington set up shop in the city of Wilmington, done all this recon. He scouted out the territory. We don't want to go into too many details on the Battle of Brandywine itself, because that could be the subject of 10 podcasts. But give us a condensed, short, 2-minute history of how we get from this situation, everybody's in Wilmington, to the actual battle and what happens during the battle.
Right. So basically, the Army starts arriving in Wilmington about the 25th of August and takes up position and starts preparing Wilmington. You know, the British start getting their forces ready down at Head of Elk. Washington, during this time, forms a light infantry corps. He tells each of his regiments to give up 100 guys, and he puts each of these, you know, these contingents under a single commander, a guy named Maxwell, and this becomes the light infantry force that actually scouts out in front of the Army. And these are the guys that fight the Battle of Cooch's Bridge during this period of time. And it was a lot bigger than people think. I mean, it was a bigger conflict, I think, than people know. There were at least 800 Americans involved. And from my reading, British committed the German Jaegers, you know, Hessians, and their light infantry forces also, cannons. It was a fairly large battle. Anyway, this takes place in September, early September. Washington has a council of war with his generals, and the generals seem to want to move the Army forward. They think it's a little better defensive terrain down along Red Clay Creek. So the Army, during the first week of September, around the 5th and 6th of September, start to move to Red Clay Creek. And Washington moves his headquarters to Newport. And he is in Newport during this period of time, thinking that he has better defensive positions. He still leaves forces in Wilmington to prepare a fallback position. In fact, he leaves engineers back there to build a second bridge across the Brandywine, and he leaves cannon, and he leaves actually a significant number of forces to continue preparing positions in Wilmington in case he has to fall back that way. Well, what happens during this period of time? Howe decides he's going to outflank Washington. He is not going to come through Wilmington, but he is going to go around Washington's right flank, which would be up towards Pennsylvania. And Washington figures this out on the 9th of September, that he's being outflanked, and then you've got the British forces moving towards Chad's Ford, where there's a major road. So Washington then, in the wee hours of the morning on 9th of September, moves the Continental Army to Chad's Ford. And that is a desperate march to outmarch the British, to get there first and establish defensive positions along the Brandywine River. So that's why the battle's not fought in Wilmington, because you can have a plan, but the enemy gets a vote in your plan. And this time the enemy decided that he was going to outflank Washington, which was a typical move for Howe. He had done this before in other battles, and he was doing it here so he didn't have to come head first at these prepared defensive positions in Wilmington. So Washington moves the army, and then the Battle of Brandywine is on.
And who won the Battle of the Brandywine? How did it go for the Continentals in a nutshell?
Well, it did go well. Once again, Howe continues this flanking maneuvers. He does send a sizable force at Chad's Ford, where the main army is, but then he sends a huge force under Lord Cornwallis, General Cornwallis, around, once again, around the flank, the northern flank of the Continental Army. And eventually, the British win the day. Washington is able to save most of the army, bring them back to Chester, and he inflicted enormous casualties on the British, but the British win the day at Brandywine, no doubt about it.
Your work as a historian is informed by your past. And for listeners who are not aware, Bill is a retired colonel in the U.S. Army. He was an infantry officer. So you are studying the U.S. Army in this case, the Continental Army. It's the ancestral, the rough ancestral institution that you served under. During your time in the Army, you would often go out on 60, 80 mile hikes, reading maps, studying terrain, and you're asking yourself, if the enemy, I guess in your case it may have been the Russians, if the enemy attacks, where would they go? What would they do based on what we're looking at? So you have a unique perspective in that you're applying that past experience to this study of the Revolutionary War. How has that affected your analysis of this topic?
Well, you know, I try not to let it affect it too much. You know, I try to go into things and just look at the facts, and you know, hindsight's always 20/20. You can always go back and look at something that happened in history. But unfortunately, we didn't walk in their shoes. We didn't walk in their boots and have to do what they did. So it's very hard to judge, and I wouldn't judge them at all. In fact, I think it's remarkable what the Continental Army was able to do, considering the resources they had and the challenges they had to face. I'm sure that my past experience probably colors the way I look at things. That's certainly the way I look at a map. I mean, I can't look at a map and not look at key terrain and obstacles, avenues of approach, these sort of things. And I think also when I look at orders, you know, and I've read almost every one of Washington's written general orders during this period of time, and I always kind of focus in on the mission and the commander's intent. And I will give George Washington high marks for his economy of the English language. He can express something in very few words, and you know, I get it right away when I read it. I'm sure the people of his day did. So I would say, you know, looking back on the way they did things, one of the things that I will reflect on is how timeless some military principles are, whether it's 250 years ago or today. Things like speed, security, simplicity. I think these things were as important then as they are today. For instance, you know, here's Washington trying to get to Chad's Fort in the middle of the night, and he's trying to outrace the British to get up there. And he's trying to figure out, how do I do this? Got to have speed. But the fastest route may not be the most secure route. And the most secure route may not be a simple route. And, you know, one thing you learn in the military is simplicity always trumps complicated. You want your plans to be simple. So he's got to balance all these things, just like people today in the military probably have to balance the same principles. So he had to look at this and come up with a solution that worked for him, and I think he did. I mean, the history shows that he got that army in place and got them in a defensive position ahead of the British, and it just didn't work out because the British continued to outflank him up there, and he probably could have had a little better reconnaissance up on his northern flank there, but it is what it is. He still did a fairly good job at Brandywine, and he certainly inflicted a number of casualties on the British that sort of stunned them and prevented them from pursuing him.
If listeners want to read up on this topic, the Battle of Brandywine, and seek out other books to learn about the battle in greater detail, what books do you recommend?
I think there's a couple of really good books that these authors, I think, just do a marvelous job at explaining the battle. So if people are interested about the Battle of Brandywine, I think there's one, Brandywine. It's called Brandywine, A Military History of the Battle That Lost Philadelphia But Saved America by Michael Harris. I think that's an excellent book. Good primer on the Battle of Brandywine. Another good one is The Philadelphia Campaign by Thomas McGuire. And it's actually two volumes. And volume one is the Battle of Brandywine. And I think both of those books I'd highly recommend. If people want to get sort of down another level into the weeds a little bit, there's a book called Washington's Immortals. And that's by Patrick O'Donnell. And that book talks about two of the best regiments that fought in the Continental Army, the Maryland Regiment and the Delaware Regiment. And there's many people that say that the Delaware Regiment was the best regiment in the Continental Army. And if you really want to drill in on that, there's a book called The Delaware Continentals by Christopher Ward. And it's a good book.
Now we get to the last segment of the podcast. Battle's over. After being occupied by the Continental Army, now Wilmington is occupied by the British Army. And that's a topic that many of our listeners didn't learn too much about in school. So who occupied us and for how long?
Well, I mean, Wilmington has the distinction. It shares this distinction with New York and Boston and Philadelphia, is that we were an occupied city. And a lot of people don't know that. Or have long forgotten it. But after the Battle of the Brandywine, the British took a lot of casualties at Brandywine. And Howe had to get these casualties treated or evacuated. So what he did is he ordered that the casualties be taken down the Concord Pike into Wilmington. And he would there they were going to rendezvous with the Royal Navy. And some of these guys were going to be put on ships. Some of them were going to be put in hospitals in Wilmington. So what he did is, on the 13th of September, 1777, the 71st Regiment of Foot, which was also known as the Fraser's Highlanders, they were a Scots regiment, marched into Wilmington and occupied it. And they were followed a couple days later by a German battalion called the Von Loos Combined Battalion. And these guys had the distinction of being the remnants of the units that were left at Trenton after Washington attacked the Hessians at Trenton. You know, Washington captured about half of them, and the other half of them they combined into this sort of amalgamated battalion called the Von Loos Battalion. And these are the guys that eventually came to Wilmington, the second group that came. Once these fellows got into Wilmington, they were a little worried that they were going to get attacked by the militia. So Howe sent yet a third regiment into Wilmington, another Hessian regiment called the Maybach Regiment. So what you have in the period of about 3 days is 2,250 British and German troops occupying the city. And here again, that's about a 2-to-1 ratio to the population. So you got another occupation of Wilmington, this time by people that aren't necessarily friendly to us in Wilmington. Now you add to that the Royal Navy, a huge flotilla of ships comes to Wilmington, led by HMS Roebuck, and he's got with him five other frigates and transports, and these fellows are here to help with the British, help with the wounded. And so you've got a huge Royal Navy presence, and you've got this occupation by the ground troops in Wilmington. And it's a very, very interesting fact, you know, that when they get into Wilmington, what do they find? They find 9 cannons still left in Wilmington. Washington apparently was in such a hurry to get to the Brandywine that he couldn't recover all the cannon that he had left back in Wilmington. And one of the stranger quirks of history is that 2 of these cannon were brass field pieces that were captured by the Continentals in Trenton, in the famous Christmas raid when Washington crossed the Delaware. And then when the German battalion, the second one, the Von Loos Combined Regiment, comes back into Wilmington during the occupation, they find their cannon in Wilmington that were captured at Trenton. So, kind of one of those quirks of history. But Wilmington had to readjust, had to accept this occupation. A lot of the public buildings were turned into hospitals. The British also brought with them prisoners that were captured at the Battle of the Brandywine. I think there were you know, I've read different accounts, maybe up to 400 of these prisoners, and they were kept in the Academy building in Wilmington. So it was probably a very, very busy and stressful time in the city. And that occupation lasted for about 45 days. It was pretty, pretty interesting. There's one other thing I'll mention, and some historians talk about when the British ships got here, they bombarded the city. And I always thought that was strange. I couldn't figure out what the rationale would be for that. And I was able to come across the captain's log from one of the ships. I found it in a research library down in Virginia. And the commander of the Royal Navy squadron that comes in clearly says in his logs that he fired signal cannon to signal the British Army when he arrived in Wilmington. And I think what could have happened is a lot of the residents probably thought these cannon were shooting at them when actually they were just firing signal shots.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
One question that just came to my mind, you told me the story of how you found an original document in your research, I believe it was at Hagley.
Yeah.
Can you tell that story? One of the lessons is keep overturning every rock because you never know where the really interesting stuff might be.
Oh, well, I think you're talking, are you talking about the map?
Yes.
The Jacob Broome map. Yeah, I read a lot about the Jacob Broome map, but I had never seen a copy of it. And I think the original one is in the National Archives. And I had a facsimile of it, but it wasn't labeled. Somebody had actually made a facsimile of it, but it just showed roads, but it didn't name any of the roads. It didn't name any of the fords. So it was kind of a jumble. So I was researching out at the Hagley Library, which is an excellent facility with a very helpful curator. And he brought out the last box of the day, and there's probably 30 files in that box. And I was really getting tired. And he said, you know, it's time to close up. And I said, well, I got one more file. And I looked at it, and I wasn't sure whether I should just close it up for the day. And I said, well, you know, what the heck. So I opened up this last file, and lo and behold, there's the Jacob Broome map, a copy of the original Jacob Broome map with all of Washington's notations written on it. And it was, for me, it was like finding the Rosetta Stone. It became a guidebook for me because I then knew what the road network was throughout New Castle County at the time. I knew where all the fords were, and I had Washington's own handwriting on the map. And some of it, he actually described some of the fords, what he thinks about them. So it was one of those wow moments, you know, and just by accident. If I had put that last file back, I'd never found it.
That's the fun of doing primary source research, because you just never know what's in a box. You might have a box that's nobody's looked at for 90 years or 150 years, and then there's something that is really significant that has long been forgotten.
That's right.
And that's what makes it so much fun. Our governor during this period did not have the best experience. What happened to John McKinley?
Right. John McKinley was the first governor, and in those days they called him a president. Very interesting fellow. I think he was a doctor. He was born in Ireland and then came to the United States. John McKinley lived down at 3rd and Willing, which we would know today as 3rd and French Street. And on the early morning hours of 13 September, when the British arrived, they went into his house and arrested him. And I've read his letters and everything to his wife. It's a very interesting story. But what they did is they had the president in Delaware. So they took him and they put him on a ship. And when he's being held, they really weren't sure what they were going to do with him. And I was doing some research, and I found, you know, once again, the University of Virginia has the logbooks of some of these Royal Navy ships. And right in the middle, I wasn't looking for this letter, and it just popped up. But it was a letter written by Captain Andrew Snape Hammond, who was the captain of the HMS Roebuck. And the Roebuck was kind of the flagship of the flotilla that was in Wilmington. And Roebuck writes this very interesting letter, and it's really a directive to one of the other captains. And he tells his captain, you're going to take John McKinley on board your ship and watch him. And let me just read a couple lines from the letter. And the British had that great sense of prose they wrote. And here's the order that he says, quote, it having been judged appropriate that Mr. John McKinley, a rebel prisoner, now at Wilmington, should be removed from thence to one of His Majesty's ships for the more certain security of his person, you are hereby required and directed to receive him aboard the ship you command. And then he goes on to say, you render him all respects and civility, that McKinley's not to have contact with persons from the shore, nor is he to converse with the ship's company. Now, I find this letter fascinating because they never refer to him as the president of Delaware. They don't show him that courtesy. They refer to him as a rebel prisoner. And what happens is that this letter is actually directed to the commander of the HMS Soulby, which was another British frigate in Wilmington. So McKinley gets put on the Soulby. The Soulby then goes down and anchors off Newcastle for a number of months. And he's allowed to send his laundry ashore and write letters to his wife, which are delivered. And, you know, he's treated very well. But he's angry that he's not being exchanged. And he thinks that George Read, I think at the time, and Thomas McCain are just dragging their feet trying to get him paroled. I'll make a long story short. John McKinley is a prisoner for over a year. He's eventually transferred up to Philadelphia and then to New York. And he isn't exchanged until a year later. And ironically, he is exchanged for the son of Benjamin Franklin, who is a loyalist, the governor of New Jersey. So that's how McKinley finally gets released. This letter is fascinating in its content. I just thought it was fascinating that they didn't do him the courtesy of referring to him as the president.
Two real quick follow-up questions on that issue of McKinley. One, I assume that the capital at this time would have been Dover. So what is he doing in Wilmington if the capital is Dover? And number two, isn't he lucky he didn't get executed? He's the governor of, or he could have been maybe executed. He's the governor of a state that's rebelling against Great Britain. Is he theoretically eligible for a more serious punishment?
Yeah, well, it certainly wasn't up to the British captain to impose that punishment, and I think it shows that he's in a quandary as to what to do with him. I mean, the British generally didn't resort to those kind of punishments. The fact, he lived in Wilmington. He was a native of Wilmington. Okay. And that's why he was in Wilmington. Of course, the capital was Newcastle. Eventually, Newcastle, it's moved to Dover eventually during the war, but the capital was Newcastle. And at this time, we are actually a state. We've become a state. Remember, at the beginning of the war, we're just the three lower counties of Pennsylvania. We were called the three lower counties on the Delaware. But he had a house at 3rd and at French Street. In fact, when he's held by the British, I've read his letters to his wife, and it's just an amazing insight into life at that time. He's more concerned about his defenses. He mentions, for instance, that the British are going to take down the fences and use them for firewood, which they did. And his wife is concerned about, well, what about the cow and the horse? How are we going to keep them? And he tells his wife not to rebuild the fence because they'll just tear it down again for firewood, which is true. And he's writing all these sort of mundane things from the ship, how's he going to get his laundry done? Did the British take certain things from his house? The British commander actually came into his house, a guy named Colonel MacDonald, who was the commander of the 71st Regiment. But he was a gentleman and kind of looked out for McKinley's wife. So I don't think McKinley was ever in danger of being executed. I just think that, they had him as sort of a trading pawn, if you will, and that's exactly what they did. They traded him for a loyalist who had been arrested, so they used him for that.
Not as good as capturing George Washington, but still not an insignificant pawn, right?
No. I mean, I'm sure that was a pretty lucky catch, And then you have to ask the question: how did he let his guard down so much? Well, what happened? The militia were in Wilmington at the time, but they kind of bailed on him that night. Thomas McCain, during the occupation, writes a letter, I think, to Caesar Rodney, and I've got an excerpt from it, and he gets a little irritated that the people are becoming too comfortable with the British, because Wilmington was a lot of merchants and traders, and the Quakers had businesses, and they were going to sell to the highest bidder, and of course the real firebrands of the Revolution didn't want the citizens to cooperate with the British. So here's what Thomas McCain wrote, and this is in October. So kind of towards the end of the occupation, he goes, quote, "The enemy that possess Wilmington by permitting the inhabitants of this state to pass in and out of the town freely and bring their effects to market by furnishing them with articles much cheaper than they were used to get them, and have already so corrupted them that to talk of giving the enemy any opposition or to prevent this free, dangerous communication is more than any now dare venture. In short, we are now in a most alarming situation, unquote. So what McCain was saying is, hey, these people are opening their markets up, and they're actually giving the British goods cheaper than they're normally used to getting, you know? And he said, how are we going to motivate people to rebel against these folks if they're essentially fraternizing with them? So,
right.
Perspective, yeah.
For anybody listening that wants to go see a site from this era, or especially the battle or the occupation, what are some interesting locations where you can still see remnants of the American Revolution in the Wilmington area?
I would do a couple of things. Of course, what I think is neat, other people may not think, but I think most of these places you can get to fairly easily. Let me start with one that people may not know about, the Hale Burns House, which is down in the Stanton area. When I said earlier that Washington moved the army down to Red Clay Creek, it's thought that this house was where he had his council of war with all his generals to move the army to Chatsford. And in Lafayette's memoirs, Lafayette mentions that there was a nocturnal meeting in a brick house there, and they think this is the house. So anyway, the Hale Burns house is wonderfully preserved, and it's open. It's got a very nice website, and I would urge people to go to the Hale Burns House website, and it's got a wonderful staff that is anxious to talk history with anybody that wants to see it, and I highly recommend that to anybody down in the Stanton area. You can see Joseph Tatnall's house that you mentioned. I don't know how often or if it's ever open to the public. I'm sure there must be sometimes when it's open, but it's a wonderful thing just to drive by or walk by and just see all those houses there that are still standing from the Revolution.
When I was next to it 2 days ago, or maybe it was yesterday, I mean, I just felt chills thinking, wow, and this is the front door where Lafayette and Washington and Mad Anthony Wayne are sitting plotting. And so I'm definitely planning on seeing that place inside. You know, that would be really interesting.
You know, Lafayette stayed in that house, and I think I mentioned this to you before, 42 years later, he returned.
Yes.
In 18, you know, and he actually, of course, Joseph Tatnall is long gone, but Lafayette actually stopped in that house with tears in his eyes and thanked his son. And I can only imagine what Lafayette must have thought 42 years later, seeing the house. You know, he was only 19 years old when he was there, but he came back and visited. A very classy act that he did. On along Brandywine Park, where you walk, there's a mill race. There used to be two mill races. There was one on each side. The one on the zoo side is gone. But, you know, people will recognize it today as it looks like a little canal. It's lined with rock. That mill race dates back to the 1770s, and it was there when Washington was here. In fact, Washington directed, when he was in Wilmington, that a second bridge be put across the Brandywine. And he had his engineers working on a bridge, and he mentions in his directive to build the bridge across the river and the mill race. And I don't know exactly where that bridge would have been, but the mill race is still there, and you can see it. And it doesn't look too much different than it looked probably in the 1770s. And everybody just takes it for granted. It's a nice sort of scenic part of the park, but it's very, very historic. I would also mention, as a good place to visit or go see, is the Rockland Bridge in Rockland, Delaware, just right up outside of Wilmington. And the bridge that goes across there, I think, was built in, I want to say, 1818. But up to that point, it was just a fort. You just forded the river there. And that's where Washington put 250 troops to guard that fort. And you can see that. Smith's Bridge, the same. I think everybody kind of, one time or another in their life, has been across that wonderful covered bridge. But in 1770, it was a ford. And it was a strategic ford. And in fact, there are many historians, or not many, but at least a few prominent historians that believe that when Washington moved to Chatsford, he actually crossed the Brandywine River at the location there, Smith's Bridge, when it was a ford. That's where he crossed. Some people think it was a little further up, but there's some opinion that that's where it was that he crossed. So I would definitely go to Rockland Bridge and Smith's Bridge. There's another ford up the river and there's a road that connects to it. If you go up Route 52, you can take a road called Piles Ford Road, which is about halfway between Wilmington and Centerville. And Piles Ford Road is one of those roads that as soon as you get on it, you feel like you're driving back in history. And I don't think that road has changed one iota since the Revolution, other than it's got different surface on it. But it's not very big, it's not very wide, but that road was used by Continental forces to move to Chads Ford. They came up Route 52 and then took Piles Ford Road, a significant number of them, and crossed the Brandywine, and then subsequently crossed the Brandywine. But if you ever want to see what a road looked like back in those days, at least the left and right side of the road, you can check out Piles Ford Road. You'd be sure to know that's some place where the Continental Army actually tread. And of course, the Brandywine battlefield, and there's all kinds of things you can see. You can see Washington's headquarters, you know, the Ring House. You can see the Gideon Gilpin House, which still stands, where Lafayette made his headquarters, and then there's a number of other things you can see. Of course, the Ford, the best way to see it, you know, is get into a canoe, go down the Brandywine. You can see all these places where the troops fought and where they crossed, and, you know, get a good map, and you can have a lot of fun if it's a nice day. But there's any number of places that are great to see.
Bill, thank you. And maybe one thing I suggest, because I know a lot of people have been reaching out after listening to these podcasts and saying how impressed they are by your research and how they're blown away by so many of these sites so close by that aren't really promoted or talked about too much anymore. What do you say once this whole coronavirus goes away and that maybe we get some people together and go up to the Brandywine battlefield and check out, show us some of your spots in person?
I'd be happy to. In fact, I think the kind of the hidden gem is some of the routes that were taken by these 14,500 soldiers of the Continental Army, which went right through northern Delaware on roads we all know today.
Yeah.
And by and large still exist.
Yeah.
And it's not that far away, you know. It's just marching wise, you could probably do that from Stanton, where they were up there. You march that in half a day.
Absolutely.
It's wasn't that far.
Well, thank you, Bill, again for joining us. And this was a great conversation. I know a lot of listeners will find it fascinating. And we hope to have you back again for a third podcast on the experience of the Marquis de Lafayette in Wilmington, a major figure of the Revolutionary War who was also quite active here. And there's a number of interesting sub-stories that Bill has dug up in his research. With that, thanks a lot and have a great day.